The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 1, Section 1, continued. Cassette 6, Side 2.
Or maybe it was solitary in the Archangel prison, where the glass had been smeared over with red lead so that the only rays of God's maimed light which crept into you were crimson, and where a 15-watt bulb burned constantly in the ceiling day and night. Or solitary in the city of Choibalsan, where for 6 months at a time 14 of you were crowded onto 7 square yards of floor space in such a way that you could only shift your bent legs in unison. Or it was one of the Lefortovo psychological cells, like number 111, which was painted black and also had a day and night 25-watt bulb, but was in all other respects like every other Lefortovo cell: asphalt floor, the heating valve out in the corridor, where only the guards had access to it, and above all, that interminable, irritating roar from the wind tunnel of the neighboring Central Aero and Hydrodynamics Institute, a roar one could not believe was unintentional, a roar which would make a bowl or cup vibrate so violently that it would slip off the edge of the table, a roar which made it useless to converse and during which one could sing at the top of one's lungs and the jailer wouldn't even hear. And then, when the roar stopped, there would ensue a sense of relief and felicity superior to freedom itself. But it was not the dirty floor, nor the murky walls, nor the odor of the latrine bucket that you loved, but those fellow prisoners with whom you were about faced at command, and that something which beat between your heart and theirs, and their sometimes astonishing words, and then, too, the birth within you on that very spot of free-floating thoughts you had so recently been unable to leap or rise to, and how much it had cost you to last out until that first cell. You had been kept in a pit, or in a box, or in a cellar. No one had addressed a human word to you. No one had looked at you with a human gaze. All they did was to peck at your brain and heart with iron beaks, and when you cried out or groaned, they laughed. For a week or a month you had been an abandoned waif, alone among enemies, and you had already said goodbye to reason and to life, and you had already tried to kill yourself by falling from the radiator in such a way as to smash your brains against the iron cone of the valve. Then, all of a sudden, you were alive again, and you were brought into your friends, and reason returned to you. That's what your first cell is. You waited for that cell. You dreamed of it almost as eagerly as of freedom. Meanwhile, they kept shoving you around between cracks in the wall and holes in the ground, from Lefortovo into some legendary, diabolical Sukhanovka. Sukhanovka was the most terrible prison the MGB had. Its very name was used to intimidate prisoners. Interrogators would hiss it threateningly, and you'd not be able to question those who had been there. Either they were insane and talking only disconnected nonsense, or they were dead. Sukhanovka was a former monastery dating back to Catherine the Great. It consisted of two buildings, one in which prisoners served out their terms, and the other a structure that contained 68 monks' cells and was used for interrogations. The journey there in the Black Maria took 2 hours, and only a handful of people knew that the prison was really just a few miles from Lenin's Gorky estate, and near the former estate of Zinaida Volkonskaya. The countryside surrounding it was beautiful. There they stunned the newly arrived prisoner with a stand-up punishment cell, again so narrow that when he was no longer able to stand, he had to sag, supported by his bent knees propped against the wall. There was no alternative. They kept prisoners thus for more than a day to break their resistance. But they ate tender, tasty food at Sukhanovka, which was like nothing else in the MGB, because it was brought in from the architect's rest home. They didn't maintain a separate kitchen to prepare hogwash. However, the amount one architect would eat, including fried potatoes and meatballs, was divided among 12 prisoners. As a result, the prisoners were not only always hungry, but also exceedingly irritable. The cells were all built for two, but prisoners under interrogation were usually kept in them singly. The dimensions were 5 by 6.5 feet. To be absolutely precise, they were 156 centimeters by 209 centimeters. How do we know, through a triumph of engineering calculation and a strong heart, that even Sukhanovka could not break? The measurements were the work of Alexander D., who would not allow them to drive him to madness or despair. He resisted by striving to use his mind to calculate distances. In Lefortovo, he counted steps, converted them into kilometers, remembered from a map how many kilometers it was from Moscow to the border, and then how many across all Europe, and how many across the Atlantic Ocean. He was sustained in this by the hope of returning to America. And in 1 year, in Lefortovo solitary, he got, so to speak, halfway across the Atlantic. Thereupon, they took him to Sukhanovka. Here, realizing how few would survive to tell of it, and all our information about it comes from him, he invented a method of measuring the cell. The numbers 10/22 were stamped on the bottom of his prison bow, and he guessed that 10 was the diameter of the bottom, and 22 the diameter of the outside edge. Then he pulled a thread from a towel, made himself a tape measure, and measured everything with it. Then he began to invent a way of sleeping standing up, propping his knees against the small chair, and of deceiving the guard into thinking his eyes were open. He succeeded in this deception, and that was how he managed not to go insane when Ryumin kept him sleepless for a month. Two little round stools were welded to the stone floor like stumps, and at night, if the guard unlocked a cylinder lock, a shelf dropped from the wall onto each stump and remained there for 7 hours. In other words, during the hours of interrogation, since there was no daytime interrogation at Sukhanovka at all. And a little straw mattress, large enough for a child, also dropped down. During the day, the stool was exposed and free, but one was forbidden to sit on it. In addition, a table lay, like an ironing board, on four upright pipes. The fortochka in the window, the small hinged pane for ventilation, was always closed except for 10 minutes in the morning, when the guard cranked it open. The glass in the little window was reinforced. There were never any exercise periods out of doors. Prisoners were taken to the toilet at 6 a.m. only, that is, when no one's stomach needed it. There was no toilet period in the evening. There were two guards for each block of 7 cells, so that was why the prisoners could be under almost constant inspection through the peephole, the only interruption being the time it took the guard to step past 2 doors to a third. And that was the purpose of silent Sukhanovka, to leave the prisoner not a single moment for sleep, not a single stolen moment for privacy. You were always being watched and always in their power. But if you endured the whole duel with insanity and all the trials of loneliness and had stood firm, you deserved your first cell, and now when you got into it, your soul would heal. If you had surrendered, if you had given in and betrayed everyone, you were also ready for your first cell, but it would have been better for you not to have lived until that happy moment and to have died a victor in the cellar without having signed a single sheet of paper. Now, for the first time, you were about to see people who were not your enemies. Now, for the first time, you were about to see others who were alive, who were traveling your road, and whom you could join to yourself with the joyous word, we. And if this was in the big house in Leningrad during the siege, you may also have seen cannibals, those who had eaten human flesh, those who had traded in human livers from dissecting rooms, were for some reason kept by the MGB with the political prisoners. Yes, that word which you may have despised out in freedom when they used it as a substitute for your own individuality. All of us, like one man, or we are deeply angered, or we demand, or we swear, is now revealed to you as something sweet. You are not alone in the world. Wise, spiritual beings, human beings, still exist. I had been dueling for 4 days with the interrogator when the jailer, having waited until I lay down to sleep in my blindingly lit box, began to unlock my door. I heard him all right, but before he could say, "Get up, interrogation," I wanted to lie for another 0.03 seconds with my head on the pillow and pretend I was sleeping. But instead of the familiar command, the guard ordered, "Get up, pick up your bedding." Uncomprehending and unhappy because this was my most precious time, I wound on my footcloths, put on my boots, my overcoat, my winter cap, and clasped the government-issue mattress in my arms. The guard was walking on tiptoe and kept signalling me not to make any noise as he led me down a corridor silent as the grave, through the fourth floor of the Lubyanka, past the desk of the section supervisor, past the shiny numbers on the cells and the olive-coloured covers of the peepholes, and unlocked cell 67. I entered, and he locked it behind me immediately. Even though only a quarter of an hour or so had passed since the signal to go to sleep had been given, the period allotted the prisoners for sleeping was so fragile and undependable and brief that by the time I arrived, the inhabitants of cell 67 were already asleep on their metal cots, with their hands on top of the blankets. New measures of oppression, additions to the traditional prison regulations, were invented only gradually in the internal prisons of the GPU, NKVD, MGB. At the beginning of the 20s, prisoners were not subjected to this particular measure, and lights were turned off at night as in the ordinary world. But they began to keep the lights on the logical grounds that they needed to keep the prisoners in view at all times. When they used to turn the lights on for inspection, it had been even worse. Arms had to be kept outside the blanket, allegedly to prevent the prisoner from strangling himself beneath the blanket, and thus escaping his just interrogation. It was demonstrated experimentally that in the winter a human being always wants to keep his arms under the bedclothes for warmth. Consequently, the measure was made permanent. At the sound of the door opening, all three started and raised their heads for an instant. They, too, were waiting to learn which of them might be taken to interrogation. And those three lifted heads, those three unshaven, crumpled, pale faces, seemed to me so human, so dear, that I stood there hugging my mattress and smiled with happiness. And they smiled, and what a forgotten look that was, after only 1 week. "Are you from freedom?" they asked me. That was the question customarily put to a newcomer. "No," I replied, and that was a newcomer's usual first reply. They had in mind that I had probably been arrested recently, which meant that I came from freedom, and I, after 96 hours of interrogation, hardly considered that I was from freedom. Was I not already a veteran prisoner? Nonetheless, I was from freedom. The beardless old man with the black and very lively eyebrows was already asking me for military and political news. Astonishing! Even though it was late February, they knew nothing about the Yalta Conference, nor the encirclement of East Prussia, nor anything at all about our own attack below Warsaw in mid-January, nor even about the woeful December retreat of the Allies. According to regulations, those under interrogation were not supposed to know anything about the outside world, and here, indeed, they didn't. I was prepared to spend half the night telling them all about it, with pride, as though all the victories and advances were the work of my own hands. But at this point, the duty jailer brought in my cot, and I had to set it up without making any noise. I was helped by a young fellow my own age, also a military man. His tunic and aviator's cap hung on his cot. He had asked me, even before the old man spoke, not for news of the war, but for tobacco. But although I felt open-hearted toward my new friends, and although not many words had been exchanged in the few minutes since I joined them, I sensed something alien in this front-line soldier who was my contemporary, and as far as he was concerned, I clammed up immediately and forever. I had not yet even heard the word nasidka, stool pigeon, nor learned that there had to be one such stool pigeon in each cell, and I had not yet had time to think things over and conclude that I did not like this fellow, Georgi Kramarenko. But a spiritual relay, a sensor relay, had clicked inside me, and it had closed him off from me for good and all. I would not bother to recall this event if it had been the only one of its kind. But soon, with astonishment and alarm, I became aware of the work of this internal sensor relay as a constant inborn trait. The years passed, and I lay on the same bunks, marched in the same formations, and worked in the same work brigades with hundreds of others. And always, that secret sensor relay, for whose creation I deserve not the least bit of credit, worked even before I remembered it was there, worked at the first sight of a human face and eyes, at the first sound of a voice, so that I opened my heart to that person either fully or just the width of a crack, or else shut myself off from him completely. This was so consistently unfailing that all the efforts of the state security officers to employ stool pigeons began to seem to me as insignificant as being pestered by gnats. After all, a person who has undertaken to be a traitor always betrays the fact in his face and in his voice, and even though some were more skilled in pretense, there was always something fishy about them. On the other hand, the sensor relay helped me distinguish those to whom I could, from the very beginning of our acquaintance, completely disclose my most precious depths and secrets, secrets for which heads roll. Thus it was that I got through 8 years of imprisonment, 3 years of exile, and another 6 years of underground authorship, which were in no wise less dangerous. During all those 17 years, I recklessly revealed myself to dozens of people, and didn't make a misstep even once. I have never read about this trait anywhere, and I mention it here for those interested in psychology. It seems to me that such spiritual sensors exist in many of us, but because we live in too technological and rational an age, we neglect this miracle and don't allow it to develop. We set up the cot, and I was then ready to talk, in a whisper, of course, and lying down, so as not to be sent from this cozy nest into a punishment cell. But our third cellmate, a middle-aged man whose cropped head already showed the white bristles of imminent greyness, peered at me discontentedly and said with characteristic northern severity, "Tomorrow, night is for sleeping." That was the most intelligent thing to do. At any minute, one of us could have been pulled out for interrogation and held until 6 a.m., when the interrogator would go home to sleep, but we were forbidden to. One night of undisturbed sleep was more important than all the fates on earth. One more thing held me back, which I didn't quite catch right away, but had felt nonetheless from the first words of my story, although I could not at this early date find a name for it. As each of us had been arrested, everything in our world had switched places. A 180-degree shift in all our concepts had occurred, and the good news I had begun to recount with such enthusiasm might not be good news for us at all. My cellmates turned on their sides, covered their eyes with their handkerchiefs to keep out the light from the 200-watt bulb, wound towels around their upper arms, which were chilled from lying on top of the blankets, hid their lower arms furtively beneath them, and went to sleep. And I lay there, filled to the brim with the joy of being among them. 1 hour ago I could not have counted on being with anyone. I could have come to my end with a bullet in the back of my head, which was what the interrogator kept promising me, without having seen anyone at all. Interrogation still hung over me, but how far it had retreated. Tomorrow I would be telling them my story, though not talking about my case, of course, and they would be telling me their stories, too. How interesting tomorrow would be, one of the best days of my life. Thus, very early and very clearly, I had this consciousness that prison was not an abyss for me, but the most important turning point in my life. Every detail of the cell interested me. Sleep fled, and when the peephole was not in use, I studied it all furtively. Up there at the top of one wall was a small indentation the length of 3 bricks, covered by a dark blue paper blind. They had already told me it was a window. Yes, there was a window in the cell, and the blind served as an air raid blackout. Tomorrow there would be weak daylight, and in the middle of the day they would turn off the glaring light bulb. How much that meant! To have daylight in daytime. There was also a table in the cell. On it, in the most conspicuous spot, were a teapot, a chess set, and a small pile of books. I was not yet aware why they were so conspicuously positioned. It turned out to be another example of the Lubyanka system at work. During his once-a-minute peephole inspection, the jailer was supposed to make sure that the gifts of the prison administration were not being misused, that the teapot was not being used to break down the wall, that no one was swallowing the chessmen and thereby possibly cashing in his chips and ceasing to be a citizen of the USSR, and that no one was starting a fire with the books in the hope of burning down the whole prison. And a prisoner's eyeglasses were considered so potentially dangerous that they were not allowed to remain on the table during the night. The prison administration took them away until morning. What a cozy life! Chess, books, cots with springs, decent mattresses, clean linen. I could not remember having slept like this during the whole war. There was a worn parquet floor. One could take nearly four strides from window to door in the aisle between the cots. No, indeed, this central political prison was a real resort. And no shells were falling. I remembered their sound, the high-pitched sobbing way up overhead, then the rising whistle and the crash as they burst, and how tenderly the mortar shells whistled, and how everything trembled from the four blasts of what we called Dr. Goebbels' mortar rockets. And I remember the wet snow and mud near Wurmditt, where I had been arrested, which our men were still wading through to keep the Germans from breaking out of our encirclement. All right, then. The hell with you. If you don't want me to fight, I won't. Among our many lost values, there is one more. The high worth of those people who spoke and wrote Russian before us. It is odd that they are almost undescribed in our pre-revolutionary literature. Only very rarely do we feel their breath from Marina Tsvetaeva or from Mother Maria in her recollections of Bloch. They saw too much to settle on any one thing. They reached toward the sublime too fervently to stand firmly on the earth. Before societies fall, just such a stratum of wise, thinking people emerges, people who are that and nothing more. And how they were laughed at, how they were mocked, as though they stuck in the craw of people whose deeds and actions were single-minded and narrow-minded, and the only nickname they were christened with was Rot, because these people were a flower that bloomed too soon and breathed too delicate a fragrance. And so they were mowed down. These people were particularly helpless in their personal lives. They could neither bend with the wind, nor pretend, nor get by. Every word declared an opinion, a passion, a protest. And it was just such people the mowing machine cut down, just such people the chaff cutter shredded. I am almost fearful of saying it, but it seems as though on the eve of the 1970s, these people are emerging once again. That is surprising. It was almost too much to hope for. They had passed through these very same cells, but the cell walls, for the wallpaper had long since been stripped off, and they had been plastered, whitewashed, and painted more than once, gave off nothing of the past. On the contrary, the walls now tried to listen to us with hidden microphones. Nowhere is anything written down or reported of the former inhabitants of these cells, of the conversations held in them, of the thoughts with which earlier inmates went forth to be shot or to imprisonment on the Solovetsky Islands. And now such a volume, which would be worth 40 freight car loads of our literature, will in all probability never be written. Those still alive recount to us all sorts of trivial details, that there used to be wooden trestle beds here, and that the mattresses were stuffed with straw. That, way back in 1920, before they put muzzles over the windows, the panes were whitewashed up to the top. By 1923, muzzles had been installed, although we unanimously ascribed them to barrier. They said that back in the 20s, prison authorities had been very lenient toward prisoners communicating with each other by knocking on the walls. This was a carryover from the stupid tradition in the Tsarist prisons, that if the prisoners were deprived of knocking, they would have no way to occupy their time. And another thing, back in the 20s, all the jailers were Latvians from the Latvian Red Army units and others, and the food was all handed out by strapping Latvian women. All this was trivial detail, but it was certainly food for thought. I myself had needed very badly to get into this main Soviet political prison, and I was grateful that I had been sent here. I thought about Bukharin a great deal, and I wanted to picture the whole thing as it had actually been. However, I had the impression that we were by now merely the remnants, and that in this respect we might just as well have been in any provincial internal prison, one attached to a state security headquarters. Still, there was a good deal of status in being here, and there was no reason to be bored with my companions in my new cell. They were people to listen to and people with whom to compare notes. The old fellow with the lively eyebrows, and at 63 he in no way bore himself like an old man, was Anatoly Ilyich Fastenko. He was a big asset to our Lubyanka cell, both as a keeper of the old Russian prison traditions and as a living history of Russian revolutions. Thanks to all that he remembered, he somehow managed to put in perspective everything that had taken place in the past and everything that was taking place in the present. Such people are valuable not only in a cell. We badly need them in our society as a whole. Right there in our cell, we read Fastenko's name in a book about the 1905 revolution. He had been a social democrat for such a long, long time that in the end, it seemed, he had ceased to be one. He had been sentenced to his first prison term in 1904 while still a young man, but he had been freed outright under the manifesto proclaimed on October the 17th, 1905. Who among us has not learned by heart from our school history courses, as well as from the short course in the history of the Soviet Communist Party, that this provocative and foul manifesto was a mockery of freedom, that the Tsar had proclaimed freedom for the dead and prison for the living? But the epigram was bogus. The manifesto declared that all political parties were to be tolerated, and that a state Duma was to be convened, and it provided for an amnesty which was honest and extremely extensive. The fact that it had been issued under duress was something else again. Indeed, under its terms, none other than all political prisoners without exception were to be released without reference to the term and type of punishment they had been sentenced to. Only criminals remained imprisoned. The Stalin amnesty of July the 7th, 1945, true it was not issued under duress, was exactly the opposite. All the political prisoners remained imprisoned. His story about that amnesty was interesting. In those years, of course, there were no muzzles on the prison windows, and from the cells of the Belaya Tserkov prison in which Fastenko was being held, the prisoners could easily observe the prison courtyard and the street, and all arrivals and departures, and they could shout back and forth as they pleased to ordinary citizens outside. During the day of October the 17th, these outsiders, having learned of the amnesty by telegraph, announced the news to the prisoners. In their happiness, the political prisoners went wild with joy. They smashed window panes, broke down doors, and demanded that the prison warden release them immediately. And were any of them kicked right in the snout with jackboots, or put in punishment cells, or was anyone deprived of library and commissary privileges? Of course not. In his distress, the warden ran from cell to cell and implored them, "Gentlemen, I beg of you, please be reasonable. I don't have the authority to release you on the basis of a telegraphed report. I must have direct orders from my superiors in Kiev. Please, I beg of you. You will have to spend the night here." And in actual fact, they were most barbarously kept there for one more day. After Stalin's amnesty, as I will recount later, those amnestied were held in prison for another 2 or 3 months, and were forced to slog away just as before. And no one considered this illegal. On getting back their freedom, Fastenko and his comrades immediately rushed to join the revolution. In 1906, he was sentenced to 8 years at hard labor, which meant 4 years in irons and 4 in exile. He served the first 4 years in the Sevastopol Central Prison, where, incidentally, during his stay, a mass escape was organized from outside by a coalition of revolutionary parties, the SRs, the anarchists, and the Social Democrats. A bomb blew a hole in the prison wall, big enough for a horse and rider to go through. And 2 dozen prisoners, not everyone who wanted to escape, but those who had been chosen ahead of time by their parties and, right inside the prison, had been equipped with pistols by the jailers, fled through the hole and escaped. All but one. Anatoly Fastenko was selected by the Russian Social Democratic Party not to escape, but to cause a disturbance in order to distract the attention of the guards. On the other hand, when he reached exile in the Yenisei area, he did not stay there long. Comparing his stories, and later those of others who had survived, with the well-known fact that under the Tsar our revolution has escaped from exile by the hundreds and hundreds, and more of them went abroad, one comes to the conclusion that the only prisoners who did not escape from Tsarist exile were the lazy ones, because it was so easy. Vastenko escaped, which is to say he simply left his place of exile without a passport. He went to Vladivostok, expecting to get aboard a steamer through an acquaintance there. Somehow, it did not work out. So then, still without a passport, he calmly crossed the whole of Mother Russia on a train and went to the Ukraine, where he had been a member of the Bolshevik underground and where he had first been arrested. There, he was given a false passport, and he left to cross the Austrian border. That particular step was so routine, and Vastenko felt himself so safe from pursuit, that he was guilty of an astonishing piece of carelessness. Having arrived at the border and having turned in his passport to the official there, he suddenly discovered he could not remember his new name. What was he to do? There were 40 passengers altogether, and the official had already begun to call off their names. Vastenko thought up a solution. He pretended to be asleep. He listened as the passports were handed back to their owners, and he noted that the name Makarov was called several times without anyone responding. But even at this point, he was not absolutely certain it was his name. Finally, the dragon of the imperial regime bent down to the underground revolutionary and politely tapped him on the shoulder. "Mr. Makarov, Mr. Makarov, please, here is your passport." Vastenko headed for Paris. There he got to know Lenin and Lunacharsky and carried out some administrative duties at the party's school at Longjumeau. At the same time, he studied French, looked around him, and decided that he wanted to travel farther and see the world. Before the war, he went to Canada, where he worked for a while, and he spent some time in the United States as well. He was astonished by the free and easy, yet solidly established life in these countries, and he concluded that they would never have a proletarian revolution, and even that they hardly needed one. Then, in Russia, the long-awaited revolution came, sooner than expected, and everyone went back to Russia. And then there was one more revolution. Vastenko no longer felt his former passion for these revolutions, but he returned, compelled by the same need that urges birds to their annual migrations. Soon after Vastenko returned to the motherland, he was followed by a Canadian acquaintance, a former sailor on the battleship Potemkin, one of the mutineers, in fact, who had escaped to Canada and become a well-to-do farmer there. This former Potemkin sailor sold everything he owned, his farm and cattle, and returned to his native region with his money and his new tractor to help build sacred socialism. He enlisted in one of the first agricultural communes and donated his tractor to it. The tractor was driven any which way by whoever happened along and was quickly ruined. And the former Potemkin sailor saw things turning out very differently from the way he had pictured them for 20 years. Those in charge were incompetent, issuing orders that any sensible farmer could see were wild nonsense. In addition, he became skinnier and skinnier, and his clothes wore out, and nothing was left of the Canadian dollars he had exchanged for paper rubles. He begged to be allowed to leave with his family, and he crossed the border as poor as when he fled from the Potemkin. He crossed the ocean, just as he had done then, working his way as a sailor, because he had no money for passages. And back in Canada, he began life all over again as a hired hand on a farm. There was much about Vastenko I could not yet understand. In my eyes, perhaps the main thing about him, and the most surprising, was that he had known Lenin personally. Yet he was quite cool in recalling this. Such was my attitude at the time that when someone in the cell called Vastenko by his patronymic alone, without using his given name, in other words, simply Ilyich, asking, "Ilyich, is it your turn to take out the latrine bucket?" I was utterly outraged and offended, because it seemed sacrilege to me not only to use Lenin's patronymic in the same sentence as latrine bucket, but even to call anyone on earth Ilyich, except that one man, Lenin. For this reason, no doubt, there was much that Vastenko would have liked to explain to me that he still could not bring himself to. Nonetheless, he did say to me in the clearest Russian, "Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image." But I failed to understand him. Observing my enthusiasm, he more than once said to me insistently, "You're a mathematician. It's a mistake for you to forget that maxim of Descartes. question everything. Question everything. What did this mean, everything? Certainly not everything. It seemed to me that I had questioned enough things as it was, and that was enough of that. Or, he said, hardly any of the old hard-labour political prisoners of Tsarist times are left. I am one of the last. All the hard-labour politicals have been destroyed, and they even dissolved our society in the 30s. Why? I asked. So we would not get together and discuss things. And although these simple words, spoken in a calm tone, should have been shouted to the heavens, should have shattered window panes, I understood them only as indicating one more of Stalin's evil deeds. It was a troublesome fact, but without roots. One thing is absolutely definite. Not everything that enters our ears penetrates our consciousness. Anything too far out of tune with our attitude is lost, either in the ears themselves or somewhere beyond, but it is lost. And even though I clearly remember Fastenko's many stories, I recall his opinions, but vaguely. He gave me the names of various books which he strongly advised me to read whenever I got back to freedom. In view of his age and his health, he evidently did not count on getting out of prison alive, and he got some satisfaction from hoping that I would some day understand his ideas. I couldn't write down the list of books he suggested, and even as it was, there was a great deal of prison life for me to remember. But I at least remembered those titles which were closest to my taste then. Untimely Thoughts, by Gorky, whom I regarded very highly at that time, since he had, after all, outdone all the other classical Russian writers in being proletarian. And Plekhanov's A Year in the Motherland. Today, when I read what Plekhanov wrote on October the 28th, 1917, I can clearly reconstruct what Fastenko himself thought. I am disappointed by the events of the last days, not because I do not desire the triumph of the working class in Russia, but precisely because I pray for it with all the strength of my soul. We must remember Engels' remark that there could be no greater historical tragedy for the working class than to seize political power when it is not ready for it. Such a seizure of power would compel it to retreat far back from the positions which were won in February and March of the present year. G. V. Plekhanov, an open letter to the workers of Petrograd, in the newspaper Yedinstvo, October 28, 1917. When Fastenko returned to Russia, pressure was put on him, out of respect for his old underground exploits, to accept an important position. But he did not want to. Instead, he accepted a modest post on the newspaper Pravda, and then a still more modest one, and eventually he moved over to the Moscow City Planning Office, where he worked in an inconspicuous job. I was surprised. Why had he chosen such a cul-de-sac? He explained in terms I found incomprehensible. You can't teach an old dog to live on a chain. Realizing that there was nothing he could accomplish, Fastenko quite simply wanted, in a very human way, to stay alive. He had already gotten used to living on a very small pension, not one of the personal pensions especially assigned by the government, because to have accepted that sort of thing would have called attention to his close ties to many who had been shot. And he might have managed to survive in this way until 1953. But, to his misfortune, they arrested another tenant in his apartment, a debauched, perpetually drunken writer, L.S.V., who had bragged somewhere while he was drunk about owning a pistol. Owning a pistol meant an obligatory conviction for terrorism, and Fastenko, with his ancient social democratic past, was naturally the very picture of a terrorist. Therefore, the interrogator immediately proceeded to nail him for terrorism, and simultaneously, of course, for service in the French and Canadian intelligence services, and thus for service in the Tsarist Okhrana as well. This was one of Stalin's pet themes, to ascribe to every arrested Bolshevik, and in general to every arrested revolutionary, service in the Tsarist Okhrana. Was this merely his intolerant suspiciousness, or was it intuition, or perhaps analogy? And in 1945, to earn his fat pay, the fat interrogator was quite seriously leafing through the archives of the Tsarist provincial gendarmerie administrations, and composing entirely serious interrogation depositions about conspiratorial nicknames, passwords, and secret rendezvous and meetings in 1903. On the 10th day, which was as soon as was permitted, his old wife, they had no children, delivered to Anatoly Ilyich such parcels as she could manage to put together. A piece of black bread weighing about 10.5 ounces. After all, it had been bought in the open market, where bread cost 50 rubles a pound. And a dozen peeled, boiled potatoes, which had been pierced by an awl when the parcel was being inspected. And the sight of those wretched and truly sacred parcels tore at one's heartstrings. That was what this human being had earned for 63 years of honesty and doubts. The four cots in our cell left an aisle in the middle where the table stood, but several days after my arrival they put a fifth person in with us and inserted a cot crosswise. They brought in the newcomer an hour before rising time, that brief, sweetly cerebral last hour, and three of us did not lift our heads. Only Kramarenko jumped up to sponge some tobacco and maybe with it some material for the interrogator. They began to converse in a whisper, and we tried not to listen. But it was quite impossible not to overhear the newcomer's whisper. It was so loud, so disquieting, so tense, and so close to a sob, that we realized it was no ordinary grief that had entered our cell. The newcomer was asking whether many were shot. Nonetheless, without turning my head, I called them down, asking them to talk more quietly. When, on the signal to rise, we all instantly jumped up, lying abed earned you the punishment cell, we saw a general, no less. True, he wasn't wearing any insignia of rank, not even tabs, nor could one see where his insignia had been torn off or unscrewed. But his expensive tunic, his soft overcoat, indeed his entire figure and face, told us that he was unquestionably a general, in fact a typical general, and most certainly a full general, and not one of your run-of-the-mill major generals. He was short, stocky, very broad of shoulder and body, and notably fat in the face. But this fat, which had been acquired by eating well, endowed him not with an appearance of good-natured accessibility, but with an air of weighty importance, of affiliation with the highest ranks. The crowning part of his face was, to be sure, not the upper portion, but the lower, which resembled a bulldog's jaw. It was there that his energy was concentrated, along with his will and authoritativeness, which were what had enabled him to attain such rank by early middle age. We introduced ourselves, and it turned out that L.V.Z. blank V was even younger than he appeared. He would be 36 that year. If they don't shoot me! Even more surprisingly, it developed that he was not a general at all, not even a colonel, and not even a military man, but an engineer. An engineer? I had grown up among engineers, and I could remember the engineers of the 20s very well indeed. Their open, shining intellects, their free and gentle humour, their agility and breadth of thought, the ease with which they shifted from one engineering field to another, and for that matter, from technology to social concerns and art. Then, too, they personified good manners and delicacy of taste, well-bred speech that flowed evenly and was free of uncultured words. One of them might play a musical instrument, another dabble in painting, and their faces always bore a spiritual imprint. From the beginning of the 30s I had lost contact with that milieu. Then came the war, and here before me stood an engineer, one of those who had replaced those destroyed. No one could deny him one point of superiority. He was much stronger, more visceral than those others had been. His shoulders and hands retained their strength, even though they had not needed it for a long time. Freed from the restraints of courtesy, he stared sternly and spoke impersonally, as if he didn't even consider the possibility of a dissenting view. This book is continued on Cassette 7, Side 1.